I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Well, the plan to fix the banking system has a new name. It's no longer the Troubled Asset Relief Program, or TARP. It's now the Financial Stability Plan, or, well, FISP. New Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner unveiled the outlines today, a three-part plan to boost consumer lending, give struggling banks more cash, and get bad loans off the bank balance sheets.
But I want to be candid. This strategy will cost money. It will involve risk. And it will take time. But as costly as this effort may be, we know that the cost of a complete collapse of our financial system would be incalculable for families and for businesses and for our nation.
Treasury Secretary Geithner speaking today. Well, Simon Johnson is an MIT professor, a former economist at the International Monetary Fund, and a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He joins us from the Institute's radio studio in Washington. And Simon, before today, you wrote, if the headline amounts are vague, or we hear statements such as, it's too early to know how much money it will take to fix the banking system, then the entire approach is not credible. Well, last night, President Obama said, it's too early to tell how much this will cost. And today, Geithner did not give a total amount. So your thoughts, was it not credible to you?
It was a bit too vague to be credible, yes. He did name some amounts. He talked about having a public-private fund up to $1 trillion. He talked about helping with consumer and business lending up to $1 trillion. But on the key number, which is the amount of capital, new capital that's going to be required that you need to provide for the banking system, there was stony silence.
Well, let's go through the three parts. There were, as you said, some numbers. The first part aimed at those toxic assets, these bad loans banks can't get rid of. The idea to raise up to $500 billion, some of it government money, some from private industry, to offer low-cost financing to investors to buy those bad loans. What incentive would there be, though, from an investor to buy a bad loan?
Well, we don't know the exact proposal. It was rather vague. He said they're exploring structures. But what we think is that it would be a government loan for you to go out and buy some of this stuff. If it goes well and it goes up in value, you get to keep the upside. And if it goes down in value, guess who's on the hook? That's the government.
The government for making the loans to the private
Yeah, so
industry.
Basically it's creating a little bit of a casino in these toxic assets at government taxpayer expense. It's a very costly way to go about this.
Well, another part is giving the country's largest banks more cash but with more strings attached. After a review of how much they'll need and how bad off they really are, the administration's calling this a stress test. But are banks that have been so reticent really going to open their books to the government?
They have to. Banks
in order to get the money?
Exist. Well, no, banks exist subject to being in compliance with their banking licenses. They cannot turn around and say that they won't cooperate. If they do, then I think they're out of there.
I guess how tough
they're going to be with the banks is the key.
Well, I guess the question too is, I'm sorry, I should rephrase. How much do banks even know about what their bad debt is?
Well, that's a great question, and we're going to find out because Mr. Geithner said there's going to be full accountability and transparency, and I'm looking forward to checking his website, the new website that he announced every day to see the disclosures on this. And unless and until we learn the full extent of the hole in the bank's balance sheets, we will not even begin to get through this crisis.
And this part you did like. It's a government website that anybody can check and see the contracts that are being made, see compensation on this website.
That's my understanding. He said financialstability.gov. I didn't get a chance to go there yet, but I do hope everyone listening bookmarks it and checks it with great regularity.
And Geithner also said, because the question is often asked, well, how do you make sure, you know, what are some of the conditions that this money will come with that it didn't come with the first time around? And he said one would be that a new mechanism would be there to ensure that every dollar that the banks received has a greater ending than was possible without support from the government. In other words, you have to have done something with those loan dollars.
His wording, I wrote this down because it's a very important phrase. He said the level of lending, what I wrote down was level of lending has to be greater than what would have been possible without government support.
Right.
Now, almost by definition, that's going to be true in any situation. That's not saying lending goes up. And actually, on this one, I'm more supportive of Geithner's approach. I think forcing banks to lend, irrespective of the creditworthiness of the borrowers, is pretty dangerous. But I think the wording he gave you there was wording that you will not be able to hold him to.
A proposal to help people facing foreclosures is going to wait for a while. They're going to come out with that in the week ahead. But the third part announced today, aimed at spurring consumer lending, to put $100 billion from the Treasury into a Treasury program to unfreeze markets for student, auto, and other consumer loans. Thoughts? Your thoughts?
Well, it's $100 billion from the Treasury, and it scales up to $1 trillion because you can use that to bring in more funds from the Federal Reserve. This is an expansion of a previously announced Paulson program known by the acronym of TALF. And it's not a bad idea. It's probably a good idea. It's not big enough to make a difference. And it doesn't address the really core problem here, which is the banking system. The big banks are almost certainly short of capital under these circumstances.
Simon Johnson, senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, with our first peek at the government's new, latest, and they say improved plan to get credit moving and to get the bank industry jump-started. We'll, of course, continue to parse it over the coming days. Simon, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We want to spend a few minutes today on a story that put a spotlight on drug abuse and anesthesiologists. Of course, not all anesthesiologists, but enough that the profession considers it a problem. Last fall, 35-year-old Dr. Brent Cambron was found dead in a storage closet at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center here in Boston, his body surrounded by syringes and empty vials. He's far from the first. In the 1840s, a Connecticut dentist named Horace Wells was one of the first dentists to use nitrous oxide, and he also experimented on himself with chloroform, trying to find an anesthetic. He became addicted, and he ultimately committed suicide at 33. Overall, anesthesiologists like Brent Cambron have far more abuse problems than doctors or pharmacists with access to the same drugs. Why is that? Well, Jason Zengerle tries to answer that question in an article in the New Republic. He joins us here in the studio. And Jason, first of all, do we know if Brent Cambron killed himself?
Until the police reports issued, we don't know for certain. Most of the doctors I talked to about his case said that they believed he did commit suicide just because there was one drug in particular he used called Vecuronium, which is a muscle relaxant, which there would be no real reason for him to use in terms of getting a high.
And at this point in his story, he had been wrestling with addiction for a while. Tell us more about that. First of all, who was he when he came to Beth Israel? Quite a shining light.
Yeah, he grew up in a very small town in Oklahoma and was a top high school student, top college student at the University of Oklahoma, and then a top medical student at the University of Oklahoma Medical School. And he did well enough at the University of Oklahoma that he managed to get anesthesia residency at Beth Israel Deaconess, which is one of the more competitive, most competitive programs in the country in one of the most competitive fields. So he was really a top-flight young doctor when he arrived here. And it wasn't too long after his arrival that he began injecting himself with morphine, giving himself intramuscular injections, which leads to probably a less intense, kind of a safer high.
Well, I just want to jump in.
Sure.
Because you say, you know, he was doing this in his muscle as opposed to when we have surgeries, it goes into the vein mm-hmm. and it's a quicker feeling. This is supposed to be safer. But as you write, every single doctor knows there is no such thing as safe from addiction with these particular drugs. You are an addict almost the first time you try it.
I do think with a lot of these doctors, though, particularly anesthesiologists, I mean, their entire job is managing these drugs in their patients. And I think that probably breeds a certain confidence, maybe even arrogance, and you know, an unrealistic arrogance that they can control it in themselves. I mean, if they can control it in their patients, why can't they control it in themselves? And I think the fact that he started by giving himself intramuscular injections rather than intravenous suggests that he thought he knew what he was doing. He thought he could control it.
But as you write, there's sort of a general knowledge, and he must have had that as well, because here he is at Beth Israel, also, I think, elected the top resident there. I mean, he's at the very top.
Yes, that's actually one of the remarkable things about him and other anesthesiologists who are addicted. They're very high-functioning addicts, and they can do their jobs really at a high level even when they are addicted to these drugs. In fact, there's some anecdotal evidence that the doctors do become addicted are oftentimes the highest performing doctors.
Right.
There's something about the personality type that leads them to be such good doctors that also contributes to their addiction.
Now, had he had any signs of addiction problems in the past?
No, he drank a lot in college and he'd done some recreational drugs, but it doesn't seem like it was anything out of the ordinary for anyone who was a college student necessarily.
Well, for a while, his behavior was secretive, although he did share it with another resident.
When he eventually moved on to intravenous injections, he was doing it with another resident. She was the one who introduced him to intravenous injections. So he and another resident were doing it at the same time.
Well, take us along Brent's storyline, because his sister moved up here. He did try to get help.
Yes, he went into recovery several times and then would relapse. He basically just had a cycle of recovery and relapse, relapse.
But how did it become known? I mean, did the hospital know?
The hospital eventually found out. It's not entirely clear how the hospital found out. They, for, legal reasons, can't comment on any employee or past employee. So eventually he was discovered. I think that his performance began to suffer. He kept a journal when he was in recovery, and in his journal he talked about how eventually he started arriving to work late, going home early. He had previously been a doctor who always showed up early and left late. He started coming in late, going home early. His appearance changed. I think colleagues of his told him he looked disheveled. One time when he was injecting himself, he passed out and cut his forehead. So he was sort of showing physical signs of the addiction, and he was eventually discovered, and he went into a recovery program that's specifically designed for physicians.
Well, this is fascinating. That speaks to how many physicians need this. But after he came out of that program, did Beth Israel put him back in the operating room?
No, he went into the program, and I think he had the expectation that when he left the program, he would then go back to working at Beth Israel. But when he left the program, he came back, and Beth Israel, according to him, asked him to resign from the hospital. And according to him and some of his friends, that actually triggered another relapse. He still had the hope of returning to anesthesia, and he still had the hope of returning to Beth Israel. But when Beth Israel asked him to resign, he lost that hope, and that triggered another relapse.
Right.
And then there were other efforts of recovery after that, but they all failed.
Well, and because he had scrubs and he knew what he was doing, he was able to walk into other hospitals in the area. He was able to get drugs, and he ends up back in the storage closet back at Beth Israel.
Yeah. He was arrested on two occasions, once at Beth Israel and once at a hospital in Norwood, getting drugs from those places. But you have to imagine that there were multiple times that he returned to those hospitals and he wasn't arrested.
Well, what do you think is going on here? Why is it? I mean, it would seem obvious that anesthesiologists have access to these drugs that give people such relief. I mean, I had surgery once, and the anesthesiologist leaned over me. It was my thumb. I'd cut my thumb. And he said, "I'm going to give you something on the street. They call it Kennedy because it kills." And he dropped the stuff in my veins. And it was the most glorious. It felt Christ-like. It was just unbelievable. And I turned to the anesthesiologist and said, "I love you." And he said, "I know." And that's the last thing I remember. Well, I thought of that in reading this story. If you watch that, if you watch your patients react like that, it might be hard not to see what that feels like.
Yeah, I think there has to be a natural curiosity there. I mean, if you're around that all the time, if you're always seeing that, it's human nature. I mean, it's also, relatively speaking, rather easy for them to get the drugs and administer them to themselves.
Well, as you tell us, anesthesiology is the only medical specialty where the doctor is in charge of acquiring the drug, getting the dose, and giving it to the patient. In most other specialties, there are two or three people involved in that process. And some hospitals are now paying more attention to that fact, as we're going to hear from the New Republic's Jason Zengerle when we come back. Oh, and later today, they're the Tappet brothers, but what if one of them was also the Kaza? That's what they'd call it, but what would Ray Magliazzi do to fix Detroit? He'll tell us later today. Back in a minute, Here and Now. Welcome back to our conversation with Jason Zengerle, senior editor at the New Republic. We're talking about Brent Cambron, a promising young anesthesiologist at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center here in Boston, until he became addicted to the same drugs he was injecting in his patients. He was found dead in a storage closet at the hospital last fall. And before the break, we were talking about why anesthesiologists are statistically more prone to drug abuse than other doctors. And we want to talk more about that. But Jason, you also remind us just how important anesthesiologists are.
Yeah, I think in the popular imagination, anesthesiologists just basically put you to sleep and it's the surgeons who do all the hard work. But, you know, without the anesthesiologist, the surgeons couldn't do anything. And their job is actually quite frightening. In putting someone under, they're basically taking over their life preservation functions during a surgery. I mean, an anesthesiologist is basically allowing you to live during the surgery.
You compare anesthesiologists to airline pilots, long periods of boredom punctuated by moments of extreme terror.
That's one of the more interesting things about the job. You can't allow the boredom to make you complacent. Most surgeries are quite routine and it would be easy to space out at some point, but they can't do that in case something does go wrong.
Well, they have to carefully calibrate, you know, as the surgery goes along, a little bit of this, a little bit
exactly.
of that.
They're constantly changing the doses, changing the drugs being administered. It's maintaining a physiological balance. And that, in some ways, is what maybe explains where their addiction problems come from. To do the job, you have to have a real interest in pharmacology and the effects on drugs on the body. So you can see how some people that interest would carry over to effects of drugs on their own bodies.
Well, but you and others say that those answers, you know, the fact that they have access to drugs, that they may have, you know, sort of a science interest in drugs, it's just not a satisfying answer as to why so many more anesthesiologists have drug problems than, let's say, pharmacists who have access to drugs. What other answers are there?
There's some research being done by an addiction medicine specialist in Florida named Mark Gold, who believes that exposure is the problem. It's not so much access, but exposure. He's taken these measurements in operating rooms trying to see if these drugs that even are being administered intravenously, if they somehow float into the air and the anesthesiologists become exposed to them during the course of these surgeries, and that triggers reward pathways in their brains that would make them addicted. I mean, it's very similar to secondhand smoke addiction. Mm. But it's very preliminary research, and a lot of people think the trace amounts that he's finding in the operating rooms would not be sufficient to actually create any kind of neurological changes.
Well, and the doctors or nurses are in there too.
Yeah, it's a question of where the anesthesiologist sits, though, because the drugs would be breathed out by the patient, and the anesthesiologist typically sits at the patient's head.
Well, and then, as we noted, there's a certain personality to anesthesiologists that might have something
yeah,
to do.
That in some ways seems to be maybe the most satisfying explanation. It's a combination of all these things, but the controlling nature that allows one to be a good anesthesiologist would in some ways also allow one to become an addict. There's something about the high-achieving, control-freak personality qualities of good anesthesiologists that are similar to those of addicts.
Well, and the fact is, as you note, the stats show that anesthesiologists do have more abuse problems than other medical populations, but not everyone is sympathetic to some of this, you know, the reasoning as to why. There was a posting on the Boston Globe website after an article about Brent Cameron's death appeared last fall. And, you know, there's been a lot of sympathy for this young, bright light, you know, extinguished so early. But this doctor writes, "I can only muster partial sympathy for doctors who fall victim to substance abuse. As a fellow anesthesiologist, we all have heard the risks of using our meds to get high, even once. We've all heard stories of colleagues found in broom closets dead with a haphazardly placed IV or needle hanging from a vein. Addiction is a disease, and those who are already addicted have no choice in the matter. But when you're not an addict and you choose this high-risk behavior, it's personal weakness and stupidity." It sounds as if there's some anger in the anesthesiology community.
I think there definitely is. I think there's a real internal debate in the anesthesia community about how exactly you deal with this problem. And I think some people want to be very forthright and open about it. Others worry that that forthrightness and openness ultimately makes their specialty look bad. You see it in the journal articles. You hear about it at anesthesia conferences. Just how exactly do we deal with this problem?
Well, Jason, there will be debate about the problem, but there's no debate that it does exist in some form, on some level. And so from here on out, what happens? What are hospitals trying to do to find out who these people are earlier on?
Hospitals have become much more rigorous about not controlling access to the drugs among anesthesiologists, but measuring and keeping account of the drugs that they actually use, how much they took out, how much they return, testing the drugs that are returned to make sure they haven't been diverted. But at the end of the day, those procedural safeguards can be defeated. I think they're trying to do a lot more in terms of education. I think most anesthesia residency programs now, all of them actually have a mandatory lecture and film series, which the doctors see about the risk of addiction. I think a lot of people who go into anesthesia don't know about the addiction problem until they arrive at the hospital where they're going to do their training and they're told about it during their residency program. And I think if maybe there was a greater awareness at a younger age, people who say are hard drinkers or maybe do recreational drugs,
they have alcoholism in their family.
Exactly. If it just became known, if it sort of became a more common understanding about what the risks are in anesthesia, I think some people who do have that history or do have that history in their families might, or friends of theirs who know they have that history, would maybe dissuade them from going into anesthesia. And that hasn't happened yet.
Well, and what about a one strike and you're out policy? Have hospitals instituted that if you're caught even once? Because we know enough about addiction to know that it is like putting a kid in a candy store. I mean, is there a one strike and you're out policy? You have to go to another arm of the hospital where you don't have access to drugs?
Traditionally, the way it's worked is if an anesthesiologist who's in their residency, still in their training, develops an addiction, that person will likely be redirected to another less dangerous specialty. But if they've already completed all of their training, I think there's been this rule that, well, they've already done all their training. It wouldn't be fair to make them go through training in another specialty, so they're allowed to return to anesthesia. But there has been some discussion now about instituting a one strike and you're out policy.
Well, sure, because I can't imagine the liability if a hospital knowingly puts an addict back near drugs.
The counter argument to that, though, is that it could discourage addicted anesthesiologists from seeking treatment, that the idea that they could eventually return to their practice encourages them to actually admit they have a problem earlier and seek treatment before it spins out of control. So there are reasons to be wary of a one strike and you're out policy. It just sort of points to the insoluble nature of the problem, I think.
That's Jason Zangerli. His article about anesthesiologists and addiction appears in the New Republic. We'll link you to it at our website. Jason, thanks so much for speaking to us.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, a community banker. He doesn't want bailout money. He wants jobs for his customers. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, Ball in the House, not your grandmother's a cappella. After the news, Here and Now. In order to keep their $17.4 billion bailout money, GM and Chrysler have to submit a progress report on how they're restructuring their businesses by February 17th, and they're reportedly racing to make that date, even as car sales continue to drop. But who's in charge here? The Obama administration has yet to appoint the car czar, whose job it will be to rescue Detroit. So what about Ray Maliazzi of NPR's Car Talk? Well, why not? Of course, he has that little day job running the Good News Garage, but we thought maybe he could give us a little hard-earned advice. Ray joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Hi, Robin. How are you?
And what would you say to the car czar?
Well, geez, first thing I'd say is change the name. The car czar sounds rather dictatorial and severe, doesn't it?
Well, I think the car industry might need it, though.
I don't know. I think they might need an auto philosopher king instead. I mean, they might need a little wisdom.
So if they had that and they had your wisdom, you know, what's the first thing you'd say?
Well, you know, it took them a couple of generations to lose market share and to lose the faith of the American buyer, you know, and I think they're going to have to turn that around, and I don't think any stimulus or any overnight answer is going to suffice here. I think they're going to have to start innovating, and it's going to have to be a gradual process where they win customers back.
Well, you're saying make a better car.
Well, they have to make a better car, and they have to make cars that Americans want. Tom and I have always railed against Detroit for making cars that were powerful and big, and they didn't make fuel-efficient cars. They didn't make small cars. They kind of ceded that to the Japanese and the Koreans. So when gas prices went to $4 a gallon, people started abandoning those big SUVs. Of course, the Japanese were selling them too, but they also had the smaller, more desirable cars and the hybrids and whatnot. Right. And then the credit crisis came, and that was the coup de grace.
Isn't it true that Detroit also has a PR problem? I mean, is it true that overall all foreign cars are better than American cars?
I think in general that a lot of the Japanese cars are better than American cars.
Oh, they are. Okay.
But American cars have caught up considerably.
Yeah, and it's just that maybe people don't know about that in some cases.
They don't know about it, and they have two generations of bad vibes to
go
away with.
Okay, so the American industry is looking at cars like the Volt.
The Volt has the potential to be a winner for GM, but it's going to be a $40,000 vehicle, whereas you can go out and buy a Prius or the new Honda Insight for about $20,000. And they have a proven track record. They've been around, you know, for a generation, and we've yet to see any Volts or any evidence that they're going to be good cars.
So hurry up, play catch up with, for instance, the Japanese automakers to make more fuel-efficient cars, make smaller cars. What else is a good car?
A car that has a great warranty. In the short term, what the Detroit automakers can do is give their customers an ironclad warranty as if the car were the best car in the world. If you indeed had the best car in the world, wouldn't you be able to warranty it? Wouldn't you feel comfortable warrantying it for, say, 8 years, 100,000 miles, bumper to bumper? I think perhaps that's what they need to do.
Make up for that bad vibe, as you said, with just offering the best warranty in town.
And stand by it. You know, have no loopholes or no hassles for the customers. You come in, there's something wrong. Oh, Ms. Young, we'll be happy to fix your car, and of course there'll be no charge.
No matter what.
No matter what.
You've been speaking out about the gas tax.
I have.
Yeah, tell us why.
Well, a couple of things. Number one, it would encourage car makers to make cars that are more fuel efficient, and it would also encourage people to buy those vehicles. You know, when gasoline was $4 and plus a gallon, people had no problem embracing little cars and fuel-efficient cars. When gasoline prices started to dip, it, in a sense, undermined some new technologies that were coming down the pipeline. I think if we have a gas tax that protects, as a tariff almost, new technologies, so if gas prices go too low, then the tax can protect those new and developing technologies that Detroit is going to need to become competitive again.
You're saying a gas tax would protect against the fluctuations in gas price.
Exactly. And if the gas price goes too high and we need to lower the gas tax, in fact, we can do that. We'll have some elasticity and at the same time not hurt the consumers. And the gas tax doesn't have to be regressive. People who won't earn below a certain level can get their gas tax refunded.
That's one of the biggest criticisms of a gas tax, is that it hurts the poor and the working person.
Well, sure. You know, for example, if you're a contractor and you need an enormous pickup truck to get your stuff around, then when you file your income tax, you can deduct the gasoline or at least a substantial portion of it. You'll still be paying some to be encouraged to buy the smallest possible vehicle for your needs.
I know you have one last recommendation, Ray, you want to get out here. You think there should be a partnership with high-speed trains. Now, is that a partnership between Detroit and high-speed, or what do you
mean? I think the government and the automakers should somehow forge some kind of a partnership or an alliance to manufacture and build high-speed trains and the rails for this country, you know, as passenger trains. Kind of a hedge against slumping car sales in a way. This would be a 10-year-plus plan to do this, and I think we could use some of this gas tax money to fund this project.
Ray Maliazzi, also known as Click, of Click and Clack from NPR's Car Talk. Hey, the Car Czar is going to have a panel of advisors. If asked, will you serve? Seriously?
Sure I would.
Would you really?
I'm not so sure I have the best ideas, but I have ideas, and they may have some merit.
Okay. Well, Washington is listening. Ray Maliazzi of NPR's Car Talk. Well, now to Washington, and the banking czar that op-ed writers are calling on to publicly flog bankers. Pat Morrison writes in the LA Times, "I want show trial sweating and stammering. When Barney Frank starts hauling fat cat CEOs before his House Financial Services Committee, I want him wearing a barbecue apron." Well, 8 Wall Street CEOs testify tomorrow before the House Financial Services Committee, chaired by Frank, in a hearing on accountability for the bailout money already handed out to banks. Congressman Frank, we've got you for just a few minutes. Flogging may make some Americans happy, but will heads roll?
There's a lot of anger at people in the banking industry, and I understand it. Basically, they made some serious mistakes and then rewarded themselves as if they had been successful. So they sort of added insult to injury. On the other hand, we need to get the credit system working again. This economy does not function if people can't get credit, especially for large purchases, houses, automobiles, industrial machinery, or inventory for businesses. So you have this dilemma, which is as unhappy as many of us are with the way these financial institutions have performed, we can't just throw them out.
Well, part of Treasury Secretary Geithner's new plan does call for restricting banks from using the money to acquire other banks and to explain how they're going to strengthen their lending plans. But what about CEO compensation? We know a cap of $500,000 has been put on top executives from banks taking money, but not on other employees.
I do think there should be some restrictions on compensation across the board. Look, we have got to put some controls on excessive risk-taking in the private sector.
So Barney Frank, I'm sure you've gathered some thoughts for tomorrow, and it sounds as if you're saying that you're looking a little bit more forward than back, but what do you want to ask these bankers about where the money went?
We want to find out whether they lent or not. As to looking backwards, you can't undo the mistakes of the Bush administration here. You can learn from those mistakes as to how to prevent them from happening again.
But how do you require banks to make loans?
You can set a baseline. You know the baseline of the loans they've been made. And you can say if the loans that you make don't increase by a certain percentage of the money we are giving you, then you have to give it back.
Congressman Frank, what do you say to Americans who, honestly are fearful? They don't understand why shoveling so much more money into banks that didn't behave properly last month is going to work this month?
The Bush administration did it badly. Their view was, we trust these financial institutions, so let's give them the money and not put many restrictions on them. The Democratic approach is to say, no, we do need to provide more funding, but with very tough conditions. And if you ask me, why will it be different? Well, when one group gives away money with no conditions and another group puts on tough conditions, then you can expect different results.
Congressman Barney Frank, chair of the House Financial Services Committee, set to grill top bankers tomorrow in Congress. Barney Frank, thanks for speaking with us today.
You're welcome.
And you're listening to Here and Now. Well, Valentine's Day is coming. What makes partnerships work? Some couples tell you they balance each other, and that's literally true for Shane and Alicia Hansen, husband and wife circus performers known as the Rolling Diamonds. They do acrobatic dancing on roller skates, spinning, leaping, twisting on a tiny platform high above the ground. It's daring, precise. It takes cooperation, communication, trust, and a sense of humor. You know, a relationship.
I wear a costume that's it's kind of like a bathing suit. It's open in the back.
We always have matching costumes when we're on stage.
My favorite one is black velvet on the bottom with pink on the top that has silver squares that shine and reflect, and then I have rhinestones.
I have black pants. They're like spandex, but they're not real tight. They're loose spandex.
As long as they don't come off my boobs or show my boobs, then I'm fine. My name is Alicia Hansen, and I am part of the Rolling Diamonds acrobatic roller skating, and I skate with my husband, Shane Hansen, and we travel in the circus with our two little girls, Olivia, who's 4, and Madison, who's 2.
My name is Shane Hansen. We travel about 9 months a year. We go from sea to shining sea, I guess.
He always tells me how much he loves me right before we get up on the platform.
Yeah, so
oh,
he
yeah.
won't
if
drop
we're,
me.
Yeah, if we're in a big fight.
You.
Everything's okay, honey. Okay. Full routine.
Okay.
Angel to start. You got the both neck spins on?
Yes.
All right. Angel.
We start spinning and then he says hup and we go into a trick.
Hup.
That means I know he's ready. He's up to this proper speed and we can go into the trick.
Hup. And hup.
And we wear roller skates. I put my legs up behind my husband's neck, and we're just spinning around like that.
I have to hold my wife up. I skate in circles while she does the tricks, so what I have to focus on is staying on the table itself. Just gotta let her do her thing while I'm kind of being the bottom person.
My husband has the, I say, most difficult part because he's gotta keep skating the whole time and not go off the edge and fall, which he's never done with us.
Good airplane.
If we are in a fight and we have to work, you still have to smile and act like everything's great. And with the skating, you kind of have that centrifugal force. So if, you know, if you want to just let me go fly off the skating platform, then he would go too, because he'd go the other way. Luckily, we don't fight that often. You have that kind of flow where he'll go to make one move, and I'll say, oh, I know what he's going to do.
Hop! And hop!
The first year was a little shaky and rough, and when we would stop and come out of the tricks, I would have to keep holding my husband's hand while we styled, because I couldn't let go. I would fall over. Now we stop and I let go right away and style and I can keep my balance. So it I would say it took, by the third year, I was comfortable in the act. But it you know, before that I could do it, but I wasn't comfortable. Now I'm comfortable. After the third year, it's comfortable. And now we're going on 9 years of doing the act together. And so I'm very comfortable.
And now the Rolling Diamonds present a piece of their own creation.
I slip up there, I stumble a little bit, but my reaction to get back on track, it's so quick. I've just been doing it for so long. It's a lot of fun, definitely a lot of fun.
Do a good one, honey.
You have to have a lot of trust in this. You gotta trust one another.
So you have to trust that he's not gonna fall or do something wrong, and I have to trust that he's not going to let me go.
Because if the other one wasn't there, then we wouldn't have an act. Or it'd be a really lame act. I'd just spin around by myself.
I don't know how many people would want to see that for too long. You are good looking, but I don't know.
Yeah!
Our profile of the Rolling Diamonds was produced by Paul Amaro for the Salt Institute of Documentary Studies. Coming up, five guys who make beautiful music together, the a cappella group Ball in the House, in the house, in a minute, here and now. Welcome back to Here and Now. I recently went to a sort of a cappella smackdown, several a cappella groups performing, each one great. And then Ball in the House took to the stage and brought that house down.
The further I go, the more I need you back in my life. And it feels I'm slipping away. And I want to get back to those days when I had you.
Ball in the House, as they say, five guys, five voices, that's it. The core of the group comes from right here in Boston, but they do 250 shows a year. I don't know how they had time, all five of them, to join us in the studio. We welcome Ball in the House founder John J. Ryan. Hi, John.
Hi, how you doing?
And also tenor Aaron Loveland. Aaron, welcome to you as well.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
And Aaron, do me a favor and introduce some of the other guys who are, you know, starting from right next to you.
Sure, sure. Right to my right here is our silky smooth baritone Dan Senzak.
That's
all the
right.
way from Duluth, Minnesota.
Okay.
And then Dave here is our R&B soul singer, Dave Giusti from Dorchester, Mass.
There you go.
And then we have our incredibly low, sick low bass, as we like to call him, from Lincoln, Nebraska, Mr. Ryan Chappell.
Hey, everybody. How you doing?
And you've got this fresh baby face. I mean, the voice is so odd. Well, here's what I want to do, John. Before we even talk about how the group got started, could you guys please just do a little live taste of something right here in the studio where we can see and testify that there are no instruments. What would be good, John? What would you like to do?
Oh, we have a song that we have a lot of fun doing. It's called Think About It.
Okay, here we go.
One, two, three. Well, if you think about it, you'll realize it ain't worth giving up on love. Just because it's getting rough. If you think it over, outweigh all the bad with no good like you should. You'll see that this ain't worth it if you think about it.
Okay, now I am testifying. John, you actually are there on the, what is it called? What is
beatbox, that called? Vocal beatbox, drums, vocal sure. percussion.
There are no instruments on the CD?
No instruments live, no instruments on the CD.
Even on, let's listen to a little bit of Addicted from the CD, just a little bit at the top there. Aaron, no sir.
No, sir.
What is that at the beginning there? That's not voice.
Well, it actually is. If you hear the actual harmony lines in the background, we actually took those in the studio, flipped them up two octaves, reversed them, and then did an effect called ping pong, which slams the sounds left, right in the individual speakers quickly. So your ear is getting this really like round, big sound. Kind of electronica sound, but it actually is 100% us.
100% voice. Yeah. Well, John, we know that you were inspired to start the group and inspired to do the beatbox because of the work of Andrew Chaikin, also known as the performer Kid Beyond.
Yeah.
But where'd the love of music come from?
The love of music for me actually came from a choir school that I went to here in Boston, the Boston Arts Diocesan Choir School, actually, which is technically in Cambridge, Mass. But myself and Dave actually went there together. We both grew up in Dorchester, but different parts. We didn't know each other until we went to this school. And for those of you who don't know of it, it's a singing scholarship school. You go for free. You sing in church every day, sing weddings, funerals, Boston Pops, just really, really cool things that you don't appreciate when you're a little kid.
Well, and not to, you know, Dorchester is a fine community, but would you have had the opportunity to have that much music if you hadn't gone to that school?
No.
Yeah.
No way. No way. that really changed, for both of us, really changed our lives.
And Aaron Loveland, we read the church was also where you first discovered music.
Absolutely.
Now, were you moving as you do here in that church? Because if so, we want to go.
You know, it's kind of a funny story. I grew up just south of Washington, D.C., and in a giant Assembly of God church where there was, you know, a 200-person choir. My mom was in the choir. And I just remember being a little kid and being so completely moved by not only seeing my mom up there singing, of course, but just kind of the reaction that the music had on the people in church. And then, you know, it eventually evolved into a passion and a love, and
yeah,
kind of comes through my family. So,
yeah, I want to listen to a little more of the band from the CD. This is Crawling Out From Under, so we can hear some of those harmonies right off the top and then talk
sure
about that sound.
I don't know the road that I'm traveling. One thing that I know is that it's not with you. No, no, I held on too long. I held on too tightly. Now I'm letting go and I'm letting you know we're through. Yeah, yeah. I'm crawling out from under. Crawling out from under.
I should say just about everyone here is using their hands to direct the music on the CD. It's very physical when you guys sing.
We really consider ourselves a soul pop R&B band that happens to do present their music without instruments, as opposed to an a cappella band that does R&B music.
Yeah.
So we'll do original stuff like we've been listening to here today, and also do stuff from the 70s and 80s and old Motown.
Hey, let's listen to some of that. I would like to hear a little, just a taste of your cover of Stevie Wonder's Superstition. So let's hear that.
Very superstitious. I've got nothing more to say. I'm talking very superstitious. The devil of his way, well, when you believe in things, you don't understand, I'll be used of, baby, 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 it ain't the way, superstition ain't the way.
There's also your beatbox. I'm not going to have you say this. I mean, I've just heard that you're one of the best. Give me an unusual sound that we don't think of. You know, I hear things that almost sound like a timpani crescendo, or, you know, there's different things I hear.
I think probably like the most unusual thing that I do, I mean, I kind of think of it as a combination of imitative sounds that have the kick drum, snare drum, hi-hat, cymbal, combined with beatboxy sounds, you know, your breath and your grunts and your different things like that. What's really cool is that a lot of those sounds that I grunt on are actually when I'm taking breaths. So it's not a drum sound in any sense of the form, but I use it to take a breath and try and do it in rhythm. So it... So
yeah,
all those things are where I can breathe, so it makes it seem like, wow, where is he breathing? How is that happening? But, you know, it's happening during some of those
right
sounds. And so I like to throw them in there because, A, I like the way it sounds, and, B, it helps me breathe.
Right. John J. Ryan of Ball in the House. Besides the CD we've been listening to, Granite Avenue, you've just released a Christmas album. You do workshops with kids. What's that like?
For some of us coming up in school, we would have had a very different outcome if we didn't have that musical outlet, I think, us coming through school. We all did the chorus thing in school. We all played in band. We all, it was a big part of our lives. And I think that specifically today, like, to have that kind of outlet, music, chorus in school, I think that's a really positive thing for kids. And for us, it's really cool to see, especially the young guys in chorus that are holding down the bass lines and holding down the tenor lines. Like, it's a neat thing to see. And we feel really kind of blessed to be able to be a part of that and hopefully influence them.
Yeah.
You know.
That's Aaron Loveland. We've also been talking to John J. Ryan, the founder of Ball in the House, and the other members have been with us as well. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
I'll let you leave. Oh,
I know you'll bring me through it.
I set on my own way so many times before, thinking I can make it, do it all myself. I pick myself right back up every time I stumble, just be a little stronger. The way that lies before me, exactly.
It won't come easy, yet I would work it out.